Well, thanks for the very kind introduction. It's a great pleasure to be here, and as you can see, from the PowerPoint, I'm stealing the title of this talk from the title of the book, which has a lot in common with the 2018 book, but it's a longer book. But partly because so many things have happened in inequality, so much more research has been done in inequality, and partly also because I didn't do nearly as a good enough job talking about the distribution of wealth in the previous book. But before I get started, two points. I can kind of see the faces out there, but they're really small. And if there's some questions or comments as we go along, can somebody wave a hand out there, so I can see. Yeah, there's somebody waving a hand. So if there's something that's not clear or you disagree with or whatever, just wave a hand, and I hope I'll see you through this tiny screen here, and then because it works a lot better if there's some sort of dialogue. The other problem, let me be, what sort of total time are we aiming at here?
Feel free, if you're able to go 20, 30 minutes and then followed by another 20, 30 minutes of conversation, or as you like.
Well, 20, 30 minutes is nothing. I mean, I go into class and I'm set for 90, but I don't think people want to hang around for all that. So if we go for like half an hour, let me focus a bit. This book's got a lot of stuff in it, and at the end of the last chapter is some policies that could do something about the rise of inequality in Canada. I want to organize the talk around two of those big policies, but there's lots more, and. There's lots more that can be said, but I think the first thing that we always want to think about is, why does rising inequality matter? Why does the increase in inequality matter? It's important. Economic inequality is important in itself, but inequality is just one word. We've got 41 million Canadians. They differ in all sorts of different ways. Inequality is about many, many, many differences. And the differences and the inequalities at the top and at the middle and at the bottom of the income distribution are all important, but for slightly different reasons. They're correlated, but they're not the same, the inequalities. I mean, we see a massive growth in incomes and wealth at the very top end of the income and wealth distribution, and that produces a real problem in a democracy, an enormous gulf and a growing disconnect between the elites of Canadian society and the rest of us. We see some widening of differentials within the middle class, which undermines the idea that we have a common shared experience as citizens of this country and a common sense of community. We see greater gaps and deeper deprivation of the disadvantaged. A basic, Canada is a signatory to the UN's Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which has clear statements on there about the basic economic and social rights of all citizens. And homeless encampments are like a walking testimonial to the idea that to the fact that Canada signs these human rights documents but doesn't actually deliver on them, because housing is a basic human right, and we signed on to that as a nation years and years and years ago, but we don't actually deliver on that right. But that's a different reason why inequality is important than the gaps within the middle class and the gulfs between the elite and everybody else, and it all filters through from one generation to the next. The inequality of outcomes of one generation of parents, that determines the inequality of opportunities of the next generation of children. So you can't talk about outcomes, inequalities of outcomes, and inequalities of opportunities independently. So the basic fairness of a system like Canada's is, you know, totally undermined as inequalities increase from one year to the next. But those are all sort of direct reasons why inequality is important, intrinsic reasons why inequality is important. Inequality is also important in its sort of instrumental way. Inequality is important because it has health implications, it has implications for the crime rate. And in this particular book, the thing that I really focus on is that increasing inequality is very important for whether we can get it together as a society to do something about big common problems. We just had a big common problem as a society, how to get through COVID-19. And we're living in the middle of a great big problem called climate change. And those two big problems have very different timescales. COVID-19 was hit with like within weeks. Climate change goes slowly over time, over many generations. But they're both all about the fact that the market cannot solve a problem of externalities when the actions of one person through burning carbon energy or coughing viruses on other people have a direct impact on the well-being of everybody else. Government is essential, and social cohesion is essential if we're going to solve big common problems. And rising inequality destroys that. So economic inequality, I think, is crucially important in itself, and because not just of the things it causes, but of the things that it prevents in terms of the big common problems that Canadian society faces. And when we think about economic inequality in a country like Canada, we should always remember that, hey, we're one of the richest countries in the world, and we've been getting richer for a long period of time. I mean, this takes us, can you see my little pointer on the screen there? Is that visible? There was a period of time after Confederation when incomes went up a fair bit, and then a big period during the wheat boom period, but then a long period of time in which per capita incomes went up and down and up and down, but there were basically stagnancy and instability through the 20s and the Great Depression. And then a long period of economic growth up until the early 80s, and then a period after that. So that creates, measured in 2022 dollars, a massive increase in the total economic output of Canadian society. And the thing about economic inequality is that these different growth episodes for Canadian society correspond to very different regimes of sharing of the benefits of growth. Because since the early 1980s, income growth has just been dramatically faster at the very top of the income distribution compared to everywhere else. Over here in the bar graph on the left, you have the top one-tenth of 1%. Then you have the top the rest of the one top 1%. Then you have the people between the 95th and the 99th percentile. And way over here, you have here. If you can still see my pointer, here's the average of the bottom 50% of tax filers in Canada. The hashed graph is the real income in 2022 dollars in 1982, and the solid is the real income after adjusting for inflation in 2021. And over here in the table on the right, we calculate the percentage rates of increase. And the basic thing that's been going on is that incomes have been growing very slowly, if at all, for the vast majority of the population. But the farther you go up in the income distribution, the more rapid the rate of growth of incomes. And of course, if incomes start out at like 2.3 million, and they grow at nearly 3% per year, then by gosh, 3% a year doesn't sound like much on a single year's basis, but compounded year after year after year after year for 40 years, it ends up in a really significant significant gap. And so income gaps have been growing because income has been growing so much so much faster at the very top of the income distribution compared to everybody else. And this is just a graphic of the top 1% share in the U.S. From 1910 to 2022. It basically summarizes what's been commonly observed in the literature. Is somebody raising a hand?
Yes. I'm sorry. If you could speak a little closer to the to your computer, because we are having some trouble hearing.
Well, that would be a good, if we can't hear, I should speak more clearly, definitely.
So, can you see the microphone in the left?
Yeah. Does that mean that everything that I was being saying up to now has not been heard?
No, we do hear you, but very, very, in very low
voice.
Yeah.
But okay. I hear a question.
Yes.
On the previous slide, where you have the different income distributions, one of the things that occurs to me is sometimes we sort of perceive those categories or those different categories to relate to categories of people, but they're not. They're categories of income or wealth. But as you go through your life cycle, you might actually go through all of those different categories. For example, when I was young, I would be in the be in one of the bottom categories. As I've gone throughout my career, I've moved up, and I'm never going to make it to the last category. But you know, I'm at least moving in that direction.
Yeah, but the point is, when it at any point in time, you observe somebody at some point in their life cycle of earnings, and at any point in time, some people are retiring and some people are joining the labor force. So when you look at a percentile distribution of earners in the labor market, it's not the same people who are necessarily at the same percentile of the distribution, but they are always being replaced by or moving up to others. So the question is whether all percentiles of the income distribution are moving up at the same rate or if they're moving up at a different rate. You may move from the 25th to percentile to the median as an individual, but if the 25th percentile and the median are basically at the same level, that's a constant age earnings profile for any individual. If you're moving from the 95th to the 99th or to the 99.5th percentile and over a 25-year period, the question is whether you're moving up just an age earnings profile over the life cycle or whether the actual positions in the income distribution are also shifting up at the same time. So it's not the same individuals that you're observing at each percentile, but the constancy of the percentiles shows the movement or lack of movement at each point in the income distribution.
Excuse me. I'm gonna mute us so we can go ahead with questions at the end of the presentation. That's okay.
So oh, you, sure, whichever.
Please speak very close to the computer sure.
So am I? Sorry, are you hearing me now?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, all right. So I'll keep rolling along. Let's go to the income shares in the U.S. And one of the basic conclusions of a lot of literature is that most of the change in income distribution in countries like Canada, or the US, the UK, Australia, has been at the very top, in the top one percent shares. There's been much less variation in the relative shares of people in the middle of the distribution. But it's a second equally important lesson to draw from this long run graph, and the income tax records in the U.S. go back well before surveys of the income distribution were available, is that in the long run, growth is not a stable process. There was a great period of high inequality in the 1920s, going into the 1930s. There was a decline in the top 1% share from the 1940s through the 1970s. That wasn't because top 1% people actually lost income. It was because everybody else's income grew more rapidly than theirs. Then there was a period when income distribution was fairly stable. And then since the 1980s, a massive period of increasing top 1% shares, continuing on to the present day. So there are very different growth episodes and different corresponding to different Paris policy paradigms for economic management. And the question, of course, is where does this lead us to? If we go back to if down here at the bottom of the graphic here, you can see a little period. Well, maybe you can see with my graphic a little period here when the income top 1% shares were kind of constant. And if income distribution were kind of constant, then the important part issue in economic inequality would be, what sort of society would you like to live in? A low inequality society like the Scandinavians, or a high inequality societies such as Chile or Mexico or the United States? Because a lot of other things happen when you got high or low inequality, like health or crime rates or murder rates or a whole range of social issues. But the thing about differential growth rates and when inequality starts to really grow is the issue becomes, what sort of society are we becoming? Where is this going to? And if we look at the incomes, the real incomes of people at the very top of the 1%, at the bottom of the 1%, and at the middle of the income distribution, the incomes at the very top of the 1% fluctuate a lot with the ups and downs in the stock market, but the long run trend is pretty strongly upwards, strong long run average rate of growth, despite the fluctuations. Not so much at the lower bound of the top 1%, and for the people who are right at the middle of the income distribution down here, pretty flat for like 40 years. Now, if you run those trends on out into the future, of course, flat trends mean flat future incomes. Rising incomes, if a high rate of growth on a large income means larger and larger income increases each and every year. So the gaps have been society between the very top and the middle. Well, they were down around 700,000 in 1982, measured in comparable dollars, up to about 2 million by 2021, and looking to go to, you know, maybe something like 3.8 million if present trends continue. And the thing is, if you're looking at the economy as a whole, then you know, if what some people get as income, it has to be either consumed or saved, and if they consume it, well, that does, you know, create jobs. It does recycle income into purchasing power, but as your income goes up and up and up, and your gaps, the gaps in your income between you at the very top and in the middle of the income distribution get larger and larger, you basically have to spend in increasingly extravagant ways to have enough purchasing power spent in consumption to maintain aggregate demand. So norms of luxury become increasingly distant from the middle of the distribution, which, you know, used to be 100 years ago, Veblen talked about conspicuous consumption being the point of great wealth. But that tends to be something that, people, you know, it's a sort of, if you've got it, flaunt it idea. So that tends to be something that people might get to resent over time. So the political instability is a major issue. Oh, yeah, this is a slide I always slip into my classes because that's the Chateau de Rambouillet there, just outside Paris. One of the hunting lodges of the French kings, he had several around the way, that water was dug out by hand labor because the king liked to look at water. He just visited occasionally while he was hunting. And so that's kind of to illustrate the point that, you know, conspicuous consumption by the very rich does create jobs. It does, you know, increase demand for goods and services. But it also can end badly. It did end badly for the Bourbon kings. And you could say that France had a pretty blood-soaked history from this 1700s through the 1800s. Not something that we really necessarily want to emulate. But, you know, why should the 99% care what's happening to the 1%? The 1%, top 1%, they, you know, as incomes increase more and more at the very top, they already have a kind of a separate world of exclusive suburbs, of gated communities, of high-end restaurants. And, you know, most people in the rest of the income distribution don't come in daily contact with people in the top 1% of the income distribution. It's kind of a separate world from most people's point of view. So why don't we just, you know, cool, chill, just not worry about it? Well, there's a number of reasons why it does, in fact, affect the well-being of the 99%. One is the evolution and of consumption norms, the keeping up with the Joneses phenomenon. If people are partly motivated by trying to keep up with what looks like a good level of living of the people that are around them, then it's kind of a cascade of consumption aspirations that goes from the top to the bottom of the income distribution. If everybody's income is growing at the same rate, that means that income shares are going to be kind of pretty much constant. So that those consumption aspirations don't increase in an unmanageable way. But if the incomes at the very top of the income distribution are growing much more rapidly than incomes in the middle of the income distribution, then the only way that you can keep up with escalating consumption norms, if you're a middle-class person or your income isn't growing as rapidly, is by going into debt and by borrowing to finance some of the consumption that you would like to emulate, but which your income isn't growing fast enough to enable. That's a recipe for financial instability in the macroeconomy, and it's a recipe also for a loss of well-being in consumption, because what used to be good enough as a consumption good is no longer quite good enough. And of course, when we talk about consumption norms, we shouldn't forget about the advertising industry, because increasing inequality it really drives an advertising of envy. When the top 1% share of national income increases, that means an increased potential market for luxury goods, a large increase in the potential market for luxury goods. So it's in the interest of profit-maximizing manufacturers of luxury goods to try to tap into those expanding markets. And how can you do that? If you're trying to sell something to the top 1% of the income distribution in Canada or the US, You're trying to sell to people who already have all the normal consumer goods that a person would need. They already have the necessities. So the only way you can actually sell something to them is by aspirational advertising to create the idea that this is a very cool watch that you have. It's a Patek Philippe watch. That is very expensive and very exclusive. It's a Hermes handbag. Now, how do you actually sell a luxury status good? Well, you have to make sure that the people who can buy it know that other people who couldn't buy it also know that it's a desirable high status good. Because there'd be no point in buying a Patek Philippe watch if or an Omega watch if nobody else knew that it was a highly status, highly exclusive type of good. So ever increasing inequality increases the market incentives to market status goods, which is, in other words, to market envy. The happiness implications for the rest of us are that we have a media that's increasingly saturated by ads for items that the vast majority of people can't possibly afford, which implies less well-being for each dollar of a national output. A third reason why the increasing top 1% shares matters to the rest of us is because, well, affluent families have a big incentive to buy more advantages for their children, which implies poorer possibilities for everybody else. If you're already at the top of the income distribution, the only possible meaning of social mobility is downward social mobility. So as the drop from the top increases, there's ever greater incentives for affluent people to try to prevent downward social mobility for their own children. Now, part of that, it comes into an arms race of parents and trying to pressurize their kids to do well in school. And part of it involves, kind of small, slow, and steady withdrawal of support for a quality public school education. Because there are always two ways in which you can win a race or get more ensure that your kids will win the race. You can get your kids to run faster, or you can not help the other kids run quite as fast. So the parental support for a quality public school education erodes erodes among the affluent as economic inequality increases, because for affluent parents, the question they might be in the back of their minds is, why do I pay my taxes to increase the skills of the kids that will compete with my kids when it comes to the job market 10 and 15 years down the road? Parents are often very conflicted. You often find that you often think to yourself, I'd like my kid to win in a fair race, but which aspect of that is most important? Is it that the idea that my kid doesn't lose, or is it the idea that it's a fair race? And the bigger the inequalities in society, the more important it is that your kid doesn't lose, regardless of whether it's a fair race or not. Let's go on. I'm going to go jump straight to inheritance taxation in Canada, because that's one of the major policy initiatives that I think we should be looking at. And I think I actually downloaded the wrong set of slides. There was another set of slides that was even better than this, but here we go. When we look at the division of the national income in Canada between capital and labor shares, it fluctuates over time. It's been as high as 54% over the period since 1961. But currently, it's It's about 50.8%, not 2023 to be exact. It was 50.8% of GDP. Now, you can ask the question, can equal opportunity for 50.8% of GDP be fair enough? We have a lot of diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives in Canada at many workplaces, not just public, but also private. And they're all aimed at achieving fairness between equity-seeking groups in access to good jobs. And that's important in and of itself. But labor compensation is only 50%, only half of GDP. There's the other half too. The economics literature on inequality of opportunity focuses, like the diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives, on unequal opportunity for labor earnings, which is kind of an odd literature in economics, because we're talking about inequality of opportunity in a capitalist society, and somehow we don't talk about capital, or in particular, we don't talk about who owns the capital. But it's inherent that assets will outlive their owners. So unequal wealth ownership necessarily implies unequal inheritances of wealth, and therefore unequal opportunities for capital income. And that's a big fraction of total output in a society like ours. And more than that, for about the last 25 years, the capital income share of GDP has been increasing. It's also the rate of return on large portfolios, like the $1 billion or $180 portfolios, is significantly higher than the rate of return on the portfolios of small savers. So there's a tendency to increasing concentration over time of wealth among the owners of capital. And coming down the pike in Canada, as in many other countries, is artificial intelligence. The IMF has an interesting working paper out just recently talking about how the artificial intelligence is likely to affect like 60% of jobs in advanced industrial economies, and that, you know, it'll have different types of effects on labor earnings at the middle and at the bottom. But somebody is also going to own those algorithms. So artificial intelligence necessarily increases the rate of return to capital and the rate of and the share of national income that's going to capital. So artificial intelligence algorithms are owned by their innovators now, but but they'll die, and that wealth will get bequeathed to some descendants. And in general, when the interest rate is greater than the growth rate in an economy, the share of the GDP received by capital tends to increase, and therefore the share of national income that's received by inherited wealth tends to increase over time. So in my research, I came across an interesting quote from 1941, when Canada had a big problem, which was how to defeat Nazi Germany in the war, and some sort of social cohesion was necessary to try and maintain wartime morale and encourage the war effort. So the 1941 budget increased income taxes, and it also increased established the federal estate tax. All the Canadian provinces had instituted estate taxes around the turn of the century, but it was until 1941 the federal government didn't participate in it. And from 1941 to 1971, both the federal government and the provincial governments shared revenues from estate taxes. That all got repealed when the capital gains taxation came in. There was a big lobbying effort by big money to get rid of it, state taxes. And since then, Canada doesn't have any taxation on estates or inheritances or intergenerational transfers of wealth. But back in 1941, Canada's Minister of Finance concluded by saying it's reasonable and just that the state should share in what one leaves at a rate dependent upon the amount of wealth being transferred. Indeed, I find this view so generally held in this country that it is not necessary to do more than to call it to mind. Inheritance taxation is something that most countries do. Most OECD countries do tax intergenerational wealth transfers, but some of them tax it as it when it's received by the heirs. They call that an inheritance tax. Some of it is taxed on the value of the total value of the estate, called an estate tax. But most countries tax inheritance. Canada hasn't done so since the 1970s. Now, inheritance taxes in most countries are like a huge source of revenue, but they're useful, a useful amount. In 1965 in Canada, estate inheritance and gift taxes were about 1.3% of total tax revenue, which isn't huge or anything like that. But if that were the same percentage of total tax revenue today as it was in 1965, that would be about $12 billion. And that would totally pay for all Canada student loans and totally pay for the Canada Child Care Plan at its full phase-in amount. And both those are useful initiatives to try to improve the equality of opportunity in this country. And 1.3% of total tax revenue would make it fairly comparable. Am I blocking over it? Oh, there we go. That's it. 1.3%, that would be like France or Belgium. Korea is the country with the highest revenues from inheritance taxation. So there's a variation across countries. But the basic idea of inheritance taxation is that we have a lot of wealth in Canada, wealth at the top of the income distribution. Top 0.5%, that's one in every 200 families, starts at about 10 million. And there are about 80,000 families with wealth greater than 10 million. And their average wealth is like about 30 million. That's the segment of Canadian society. That if there's no inheritance taxes and it just passes from one generation to the next without tax hit, 5% rate of return is relatively low for large portfolios, but a 5% rate of return on a $10 million portfolio is $500,000 a year in perpetuity. As long as you don't touch the principal. So somebody with an inheritance of 10 million or so doesn't have to work for a living. That's the top half of 1% of Canadian society. It was the top half of 1% of French society in the late 18th century, who were the aristocrats of the country. They, of course, inherited their position in society by inheriting landed estates. And in Canada, people inherit their position in society by inheriting bond portfolios or share portfolios of shares and bonds and financial instruments. So it's a slightly different picture, but there's still no need to work for a living if you get that sort of inheritance. And, of course, at the very top is my picture showing up here and obscuring everything else, or there? What? Let's move that around a little bit. And at the very top of the wealth distribution in Canada, you have the multi-billionaire families. who did pretty well during the pandemic. This table is drawn from the Forbes database of top end wealth. Forbes magazine in the States constructs these lists of billionaires around the world, and it's incomplete because we know that some of the great family fortunes of Canada aren't there because those family fortunes are held through family trusts and rather not by individuals. But the little red asterisks here, it just picks out the names of the families that a guy named Peter Newman back in 1975 wrote a book called The Canadian Establishment, which identified the top 19 family fortunes in Canada. They were at the top in 1975, and they're still at the top, passing their fortunes from one generation to the next, unimpeded by tax. And of course, as I say, the Desmarais and the Richardsons and the Rogers and the Shaw, they should be in this list, but they're not, because this is a list constructed by the journalists at Forbes Business Magazine, and misses out on some of the wealth that's held indirectly through family trusts. So if we should then maybe ask the question, why should we tax large inheritance? Why shouldn't we just let it pass from one generation to the next? Historically, Canadian provinces, back in around the turn of the century, and 100 years ago, all instituted inheritance taxes, and partly it was because there was a belief that democratic societies had a landed aristocracy driving the political decisions, political and social decisions for centuries, and they didn't want to have that landed aristocracy replaced by a financial aristocracy.
Sorry to interrupt you, Lars. Sorry to interrupt. We have about 10, 15 minutes left.
Okay, it won't be that much longer.
Okay, no problem. Just wanted to let you know, just because we have to be out of the room at a certain time, and I just want to make sure we have time for questions.
Okay.
And then what we can do about 20 minutes, 15, 20 minutes of questions.
Okay. So I'll say the historical argument was partly democratic, partly feasibility, because in order to transfer assets from one generation, it had to go through a probate process. But we had probate estate taxes in Canada before we had income taxes. And there's a moral argument, too, that capital income is the passive receipt of income. There's no effort is involved. And it's always been the case that estate taxes exempt small bequests. Small inheritances can be very important for people who have even little already. So there's always something you want to exempt, things like housing or the family farm or small family businesses. So let me jump over this and jump over this. The political economy impacts of not taxing large inheritances in Canada. There's the political instability of fundamental unfairness. If it becomes widely perceived that Canadian society is dominated by foreign ownership and large family fortunes, and everybody else's incomes just remain pretty stagnant, then that creates a whole bunch of political instability. And it also creates what we've seen in Canada as kind of a malnutrition of civil society. Inheritance taxation can be seen as a big tax incentive to charitable donations. In the U.S., the top estate tax was 77% when the Ford and Rockefeller foundations were established. And it only cost Henry Ford like 23 cents on the dollar to establish the Ford Foundation, which is kind of a big tax incentive. But there is some benefit in having a pluralism of foundation founding alternatives rather than just a few centralized government sources for research and cultural endeavors and scientific research. I'd argue that we want to tax wealth. We don't want to tax, if we're going to tax wealth, it shouldn't be on an annual income basis. We could tax it annually, but it's easier if you tax it at the time when it transfers between generations, because there's a well-established probate process already in existence. Tax inheritance is greater than 20, 2.5 million as income. That's my proposal. Ontario could lead the way. Many US, 18 US states already have estate or inheritance taxes. The benefit cost ratio, the benefit of an estate tax is the tax revenue you get from taxing the estate. The cost is whether the billionaire moves away before he dies and you lose the income tax on the years that you would otherwise have paid income tax. If you compare the benefits and the costs, the benefits outweigh the costs, even for U.S. states. So it's a net winner, even if at the provincial level, to increase the institute in estate taxes. But I also want to take, if we only have 15 minutes, we can't go away without talking about full employment. We had a massive shift in Canada in the 1980s. Under the Keynesian consensus of macro policy through the 40s, 50s, 60s, into the 70s, full employment and price stability were both major objectives of monetary policy. And if you look at this graph of historic unemployment rates in Canada, and unemployment's been measured in Canada in comparable ways since the 1946, back in the 1950s, it was averaging under 4%. It crept up into the 5% range, a brief bump here, over 6%. But until the 1975, it was extremely rare to see unemployment above 6%. Since 1980, we've seen unemployment that has been continuously above 6%, and more normally like 8% and 9%. So Canadians have become habituated to the idea that it's people who have to chase jobs rather than jobs that have to chase people. And that makes a fundamental difference to power at the workplace and the distribution of income. I'm going to take a brief here. The 1946 to 80 period corresponded to a long period of time when real wages in Canada continued their upward march. And it was a long period of time in Canada when each generation of Canadians could reasonably expect that their kids would make more money than them. There was upward progress. That came to a screeching halt in 1980, and when average real wages started to stagnate. So up until about 1980, you could make the argument that inequality wasn't great, but it was the price that Canadian society paid for everybody's income to go up. Since 1980, that's not a plausible argument. Inequality has increased, but average living standards have basically stagnated for most people. After 1982, the unemployment rate became a residual variable. Real hourly wages and median incomes started to stagnate. And the thing about low unemployment is that it's a worker's best friend. Demand for labor is always derived from the demand for goods. And when if people are chasing jobs or jobs are chasing people, it makes all the difference to the balance of power at the workplace. When firms can't get enough workers, each unfilled vacancy is a loss in profits. And firms have an incentive to make their jobs attractive. To try to find whatever it takes to fill those vacancies. Unfilled vacancies are expensive when it's jobs chasing people, when there's a queue of qualified people outside the door, it's the disadvantaged, it's the racialized minorities, it's the discriminated against who are at the back of that queue. And so labor market scarcities, that's absolutely a worker's best friend, and especially a disadvantaged worker's best friend. So that is, okay, let's stop there. Gotta have some questions.